Westminster Confession, chapter 19 and paragraph 4. Chapter 19, paragraph 4. To them also, as a body politic, he gave sundry judicial laws, which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any other now, further than the general equity thereof may require. So, judicial laws not automatically standing. Judicial laws not automatically standing. First of all, God gave judicial laws to Israel, and this was unique. God gave judicial laws to Israel, and this was unique. To them also, as a body politic, he gave sundry judicial laws, which expired together with the state of that people. And it gives Exodus 21 and 22 as an example. And the judicial laws include laws which were unique to the land of Israel and its division and to their inheritance in that land, and therefore which have no counterpart today. That illustrates the fact that the situation of nations today is not compatible with that of Israel. It's true that the state is to acknowledge Christ's kingship, but that doesn't mean that nations become church state together. The church is still distinct from the state, not simply in its government, which arguably it always was, but also in its membership. Membership of the church and membership of the state are not one and the same thing, whereas that was more or less the case in Israel. Genesis 49 and verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. And then with that, 1 Peter 2, 13 to 14. 1 Peter 2, verse 13 to 14. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or unto governors as unto them that are sent by him, for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of them that do well. Now, the first of these texts shows that Christ's coming marked the fulfilling of the kingship in Israel. So, there were no typical kings after Christ had come. David and Solomon typified, more than typified, they gave a foreshadow or a foretaste of the kingship of Christ. They were appointed by God. They did actually rule. They were anointed to be his representatives. And David particularly showed the triumph of Christ over his enemies, and Solomon, the peace that submission to Christ brings, and so on. But with the coming of Christ, there is no more typical kingship. And 1 Peter shows that the Lord requires submission of us, even to pagan kings, so far as it doesn't involve us in sinning. And so Christ's kingship in the New Testament is not in the form of a church state, though the state is duty-bound to submit to Christ as the gospel is preached in a nation. It is the duty of that nation collectively and with its leaders leading the way to bind themselves to submission to Christ. But that isn't the same as covenanted nations becoming automatically equivalent to the professing church. So, in the New Testament, there is no entity equivalent, exactly equivalent, to Israel. Israel was the church first, and then it took on the national form of a body politic. Secondly, this is the same thing really, Israel's position was unique. We've overlapped. Israel's position was unique. The text given, Matthew 5:17. Matthew 5:17. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. Now, the law was fulfilled by Christ, either abrogating what was temporary and fulfilling what was moral and redeeming a people who would begin to fulfill the righteousness of the law from the heart. So the law is not destroyed insofar as it was ceremonial and judicial and therefore preparatory. Christ fulfilled it and brought about its termination. Insofar as it was moral, he fulfilled it all, bore the penalty of its transgression, and his people continue to show their submission to the Christ of God by conforming to that law. Now, in Matthew 5, verse 38 and 39, we read, "Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also." The moral principle of the law for the individual continues. And indeed, the principle of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth as a principle of civil justice continues. But they must be kept separate, and therefore change in the obligation of a state from that which applied to Israel does not impinge upon the permanence of the moral law. The abrogation of temporary aspects of the penalties attached to transgression, the civil penalties, does not affect the permanence of the moral law, though the principle of an eye for an eye does actually remain as the basis of civil law. The Westminster Confession says that the penalties are abrogated with the state of that people, that is, Israel as church and state together. There is no nation that is both church and state now. Church and state are to submit to Christ. The church has a duty to teach, bear witness and teach the state its duty. The state has a duty under Christ to uphold the whole moral law in the public realm and therefore to protect and facilitate the church in its distinctive functions. But the two are separate, not only in government, but in membership as well. So the penalties were in the Old Testament, because they were the penalties of Israel as church and state, the death penalty was also a form of excommunication from the church. And that's important, and it's important for us to grasp that it isn't conceding any ground to the idea of neutrality in the state now to say that Israel was unique in that the death penalty was the mode of excommunication from the church, as well as civil punishment. This is well illustrated in Deuteronomy 13, verse 5. Deuteronomy 13 and verse 5. And that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death because he has spoken to turn you away from the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you out of the house of bondage, to thrust thee out of the way which the Lord thy God commanded thee to walk in. So shalt thou put the evil away from the midst of you. And that last sentence, when translated into the Greek Septuagint, is the sentence which the apostle, it's the language which the apostle uses in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 13, 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 13, but them that are without God judgeth, therefore put away from among yourselves that wicked person. So the language of the death penalty in Deuteronomy is applied to excommunication from the church by the Apostle Paul. And the language of putting away from his people used in the Old Testament, and we believe in reference to the death penalty, is used also of the Jews casting out of the synagogue. The Jews were not generally allowed to put to death without the Romans being involved, but they had to settle for putting out of the synagogue. But it's the same language as is used from putting away among his people in the Old Testament. So in the Old Testament, excommunication was by death. And when the person being excommunicated was normally stoned by the people, the sentence was upheld by the people. And as such, it was an irreversible excommunication as far as the church in this world is concerned. Whereas in the New Testament, God's grace being more abundantly displayed, there is the possibility of reversal. So the church and the state are both to submit to Christ. They both have obligations to one another, but they are not coextensive, and that is a difference in the New Testament. And since the church and state of Israel, the death penalty, had a church function as well as a state function, then all the death penalties in the Old Testament are not automatically binding on a nation in the new. The death penalty for murder, for example, is a standing institution. It's appointed in Genesis 9 before the Mosaic administration ever was in place, and it's based on moral principle that the man is made in the image of God, and therefore the murderer is to be put to death. Thirdly, principles of general equity. Principles of general equity. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 8. 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 8. Say I these things as a man, or saith not the law the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses, thou shalt not muzzle the mouth of the ox that treadeth out the corn. Doth God take care for oxen? Or saith he it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he that ploweth should plow in hope, and that he that thresheth in hope. should be partaker of his hope. The apostle there takes the instruction for animals not to muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn as teaching a principle of equity, that the labourer is worthy of his hire. And in Colossians he tells, "Masters, give to your servants that which is just and equal." And he draws an application from that principle. Insofar then as the penalties reflect natural justice, they are of abiding significance, but they are not automatically binding, since Israel's position as church and state was unique. So the ceremonial law is abrogated, the judicial law, the judicial laws are only applicable so far as they can be shown to be expressions of permanent natural justice. Whereas the moral law is automatically binding and carries on into the New Testament. For a fuller treatment of this, we did an after church meeting some long time ago now on the Westminster Assembly and the question of theonomy. And if you have time to listen to that, you'll get a fuller picture in doing so. The ruler is, however, to take the Ten Commandments, the moral law summed up in the Ten Commandments, as his starting point. He is to be a punisher of evil, and only God can define evil. And therefore, the whole moral law is his starting point, and transgression of that law, when sin, the transgression of the law, reaches a point of becoming a public matter, then that becomes the concern of the civil magistrate. He is to punish on the basis of God's definition of evil, and when that evil becomes a matter in the public domain. And so he is to acknowledge Christ as the prince of the kings of the earth, as well as being the head of the church. And the government of the church is distinct under church officers, distinct from the civil magistrate. So the church is to have its own government over its own functions, and the state is to punish evil as defined by God and within its own proper sphere. That doesn't mean that anything can go on in the church and the state has no right to intervene. If there is public transgression of the moral law, even by a church officer or within the bounds of the church, it is still a matter for the civil ruler to take notice of and to act accordingly. But church and state have distinct government, distinct officers, and distinct membership. But church and state are to acknowledge Christ. Kings are obliged to kiss the Son as kings, lest his wrath be kindled but a little, and they perish from the way.